Krishna consciousness, or as it is known in ancient times, bhakti yoga, is possible even in this day and age. Of course, a smart person will understand there's nothing really so great about this present day and age. I was just speaking in Mumbai a few days ago. That's where I was before I came here to be with you all. So, I was telling these students and young professionals in Mumbai how the perception of Mumbai around the world has changed. And this change is broadcast by the news media. I've seen in New York, I've seen in newspapers in New York, airlines, magazines, they all refer to Mumbai as one of the world's greatest party cities. And they always scold the reader. Don't think Mumbai is just some old Indian city with traditional values. Now it is a party capital of the world, with pubs and bars and clubs, home of the big money and the beautiful people. In fact, the British Airways magazine had a very beautiful description of Mumbai. Beautiful. They thought the highest compliment, the highest accolades, the highest honor. You know, when there's a volcano, and the volcano erupts, the hot lava comes from down below, and it shoots up through the volcano and then spreads out through the land. That hot lava is molten. I mean, it's liquefied. So, the British Airways magazine referred to Mumbai as the molten epicenter of Asian hedonism. It was a compliment. it's like the winning the World Cup. The molten epicenter of Asian hedonism. That word hedonism is no longer considered an insult. Maybe 20 years ago, if someone called you a hedonist, you would become very angry. Now you would feel very glorified. Oh, I'm a hedonist. Thank you so much. I'm on the cutting edge. I'm in the advance guard. So, this is the nature of the world as some people would like it to be today. But not everyone. Others are very concerned. How can an intelligent person live a sane life these days? And what does it mean to live a sane life? To have a balanced lifestyle of spiritual values and spiritual attainment while you're fulfilling your material necessities. I know so many of you, if not all of you, are concerned with these points, otherwise you wouldn't be here. You may have some hopes for wealth and comfort, but I hope you're wondering, is that the main goal of my life? And will that really satisfy me? And what else could I be doing besides chasing the dream? Now, we're going to do a preliminary exercise here. We're going to have some job screening for who is fit to attend this seminar. I know you all have experience, or you will experience, job screening and interviews. So, first of all, let me ask you something. I heard this from our Nityananda Priya. He told me that when an IBM managemental guru came to Australia to fire the troops, probably warn them, you know, you become more enthusiastic or we outsource everything to India. Anyway, he was speaking to a few hundred IT workers for IBM, and as he walked around while speaking, he asked them, what are the kind of persons we want working for IBM? I want to know, look each one in the eye, when you wake up in the morning and open your eyes, is it so that the first thing you think of is your job? Those are the kind of persons we want. As soon as your eyelids open, you think of your work. If you don't do that, be prepared to be downsized, made redundant. If you're going to stay with this company, your job has to be everything. Otherwise, there are so many willing to take your place. So how many of you do that? As soon as you wake up in the morning, you think of your job or your studies immediately when your eyes open. Raise your hand. All right, so you all passed the first test. The second test, however, how many of you can multitask? Raise your hands, please. None of you can multitask? One, only one can multitask. Come on. Nobody can multitask. Isn't that a topmost job requirement these days? Yes. Because in order to cut costs, the employees have to be able to do more and more. The higher management is always trying to impress upon you that everyone, we all have to do our bit to increase the productivity and lower the costs. We all are on the same boat together. And then as the costs are reduced because everyone has to work more, what's the reward you get? You simply get more work. And the higher management gets all sorts of incentives and bonuses. But when it's time to speak, they say, we're all in the same boat. We all have to do our part. So this is the working world these days. Now, multitasking is not the glorious thing that it's made out to be. In no way can the human brain effectively act like a computer. This is a complete myth. Still, employers expect this of you. If you're going to rise in the ranks, you have to be able to multitask. But if you understand how the brain works, you understand they're asking you to injure yourself. Last year, 50% of the Australian workforce said that by the time the year ends, they're totally drained. By the time Christmas comes, January 1st, they're totally drained and exhausted and wonder how they can go through another year. Then you look at the U.S., their workforce says, 45% of the U.S. workforce says that we're being asked to do too many things all at the same time. And there is scientific evidence for their discontent about that. You see, a computer can process in the background while in the foreground it's doing other things. The human brain can't do that effectively. Testing shows that the human brain best works when you do one task, complete it, and then switch to another. Otherwise, if you try to do two tasks at once, say you're trying to write a report while you're answering email at the same time, your productivity is down 2/3. The brain has to reduce its concentration powers 2/3 from if you had done each task separately. Now, what actually happens when you are so-called multitasking? You get to your office, you're answering the phone, you're doing some email, you're talking to someone, thinking of a presentation you have to make, all at the same time, and you might feel, oh, I'm very efficient, I'm right on the cutting edge. But no. What's actually going on is that your brain isn't multitasking. It's an illusion that you're multitasking. What actually is happening is your brain is channel surfing. Like when you have a remote control in your hand and you watch television and you rapidly switch from one channel to another. The brain is actually in 3-second bursts focusing on this, then that, then that, then that, and then back to the first task. So you think, I'm multitasking, I'm doing everything at once, but the brain's not working like that. It can't. It's focusing on a specific task for a very short amount of time, 3 seconds. But you can't notice that 3-second focus. So you think you're doing things all at once, when actually your brain is switching very rapidly. So when you try to go through this illusion that you're multitasking, you cause yourself so much stress. Because the same part of the brain that sets priorities is also the part of the brain most susceptible to stress. So you bring all these problems upon you based on this illusion that you can do so many things at once. You bring so much stress and so much anxiety, but the workplace is pushing you, multitask, do more. You have to increase your output if you want to hold your place. In this way, people are becoming more and more disturbed. The rewards that you're being offered seem very glamorous, but the price you pay is increasing daily. So intense what is demanded of you. Now, even though you may know that, how are you going to resist taking part in this mad race? On your own, it's practically impossible to resist. You must have the association of spiritually minded persons to fortify you, to strengthen you. Otherwise, on your own, as a single person, you can't handle this pressure. It's too much. As a single person or as a family unit, you'll be just flooded over by all this pressure and demand. You have to do this, you have to do that. You must get ahead, you must do more. You must do many things at the same time. You won't be able to handle it. And the result will be stress increases more and more. And as the stress increases more and more, where is it that you look for relief? This is why intoxication plays such a big role in management circles. It's not possible to wind down from all this artificial so-called multitasking without the aid of alcohol and even other things stronger. What happens is that when Friday comes, and you know the expression they have in the Western world, the only time they glorify God is Friday. Thank God it's Friday. No one knows anything about God, but thank God it's Friday. So, you're so stressed and you're so exhausted, you can't even relax on the weekend. You're still wired up from multitasking. You're so much on edge. Finally, by the time you may relax a little bit, it's Sunday evening, and then Monday morning is back to the same thing again. So what is that sense of false honor that keeps us going at such a pace? Maybe you're thinking, oh, my relatives back in India will think so highly of me that I have this job. I don't know the pressures I'm under, but still I have to keep up this illusion that I have succeeded overseas. Of course, the same kind of pressures coming to India now also. An intelligent person thinks about these things. But even though you may think about them as an individual, as a family unit, you won't be able to do anything about it on your own. The power of this kind of stress culture is too much. The demands placed on you are too intense. You can't resist. You even tell yourself, I know this is so stressful. I know this is turning me upside down, but this is what you have to do to get ahead. This is what you have to do in order to be known as a competent person. I have to handle this somehow or other. No, you don't have to. And what we hope to give you this weekend is the strength to make better priorities for your life. We hope to do that. We hope to equip you with the tools to be able to, so that you'll be able to establish for yourself a much higher way of acting. And in this way, you'll be much more satisfied with yourself. The world is offering you a false sense of honor. You're working so hard, you're achieving so much. But what is it that you're achieving? You're losing your peace of mind. And what do you get in return? When you look at it, what you get in return is not at all very valuable. Simply to rest peacefully is such a rare thing. To rest peacefully with no anxiety is such a rare achievement these days. Something a simple villager in India can easily do, rest peacefully. You're being denied by this present culture. Work, buy, consume, and die is a good mantra. Work, buy, consume, and die. I hope that you have higher aspirations than this. Now, we're not saying no one should work. Of course, we're not saying that. In one sense, I also work too. It's very demanding, so much traveling, to get on the airplane in Mumbai, fly 12 hours to Sydney, then an hour and a half, change planes after going through customs immigration, fly an hour and a half to Melbourne. I've been traveling internationally for over 25 years. No, it is work. But it's a labor of love. Now, you all, of course, either have families or will have families, most of you. And you must support those families. You must be responsible. But part of your responsibility towards yourself and your family is to make sure you don't drive yourself crazy with stress and anxiety. That's also part of your commitment and responsibility to yourself and to your family. The only result that can come from such a high stress, high anxiety lifestyle is you must take to drinking. There's no other alternative. Your whole weekend has to just be drowned in alcohol. That's where this kind of high-stress lifestyle leads. And because you're so stressed, you're so full of anxiety, you can't be satisfied with simple family life anymore. You see, a human being is, another human being is not able to solve these stress problems for you. So you come home to your family, if you have one now or when you have one in the future, you're expecting relief, you're expecting freedom from anxiety, you're expecting something pacifying, peaceful to happen to your mind. It doesn't. And therefore you start to think, what's the use of this family? Now, maybe 10 years ago, 20 years ago, this would be unheard of for an Indian family. But now it's becoming more and more common. My wife does not make my mind peaceful. What is the use of this situation? Then you talk to your Australian cohorts at work or at the university, and they just tell you, if she's no longer doing the job for you, then just drop it. What's the difficulty? You stay with her as long as the benefits are there. And when the benefits aren't there, you move on. We all do this. Of course, when I was in Mumbai, I was told that newspapers are designed for the masses, and the centerfold is pornography. And they make the price of newspapers very cheap in order that the people become addicted to getting those newspapers. And also, there in Mumbai, there are four of these type of tabloid newspapers with pornography in the center, all competing with each other, and each making the price low so that the common person will buy them, buy one, become addicted, and each newspaper's hoping will be the one that survives this price war. But what surveys have found that what is actually happening? It's not that the ordinary person is choosing, I'll take this trashy newspaper instead of that one. They're buying them all. But they're buying all four of these trashy tabloid newspapers, attracted by the pornography in the center. And then, in these newspapers, there's always a section devoted to the ladies. And there, they have other ladies writing in questions and giving answers. And the whole point is, don't follow tradition anymore. Don't be an imprisoned woman. Free yourself. Do whatever you feel. Throw all traditions out the window. Get rid of all repression. Repression means sense control. Get rid of all inhibition. Don't have your life shaped for you by these old traditions. The whole world is waiting for you. So, this is what's going on. Now, many of you will stay here once you finish school. What is your future here going to be? As the workplace triples the pressure it puts on you, it has to triple. Otherwise, if they can't triple your output, they'll just move everything to India and continue the same process there. In other words, they've already destroyed Australia now. So, you may take pride, oh, India's getting so much business, it's getting so much investment, and it's getting all the problems. Australia's already been destroyed. The workforce is just driven crazy. Everyone's been exploited, and now they'll move everything to India and do the same process on everyone's mind. Stress, anxiety, destroy the family, destroy your mental peace. Because there's so many call centers in India now, young people if they can halfway speak English, they can get a job at a call center. And generally they would not have such disposable income as they do now. And therefore, they have this income, there has to be something a young person will want to spend the income on. So, with young people having more money than they would normally have, they're using it, of course, for unhealthy things, unsavory things, sinful things. And the parents don't know what to do. You see, I was discussing with some of our leaders in India how the situation in India between parents and children is a lot like the situation was in the USA in the 60s. When I say children, I mean teenagers and in their 20s. There's a great gap in understanding between the parents and those, their children who are under 30. The sons and daughters are living in a completely different world. The parents, whether they were religious or not, generally are bound by tradition. There's certain things you do, there's certain things you don't do. There's certain family norms that you follow, cultural norms. But those under 30, especially those who are overseas, they're seeing beyond all that. You want to be known as multicultural, multinational, beyond some village tribal identity. Yeah, it seems very primitive to be restricted in your identity to how your grandmother and grandfather saw themselves. You think, I'm here in Australia. I want to be known as a global citizen. I can appreciate India. I can appreciate Australia. I understand things from so many different cultural angles. That is the new sophisticated niche. So, the parents, although they, of course, like the money that their children send home from overseas, they really have not much understanding of how to cope with the lifestyle of their children anymore. This is like in the USA in the 60s, during the countercultural hippie times. The parents had no idea what it is their teenage children, their children in their 20s, what are they doing? Taking LSD, so-called free love. The parents couldn't conceive all these things. They just couldn't compute, you know. It was impossible for them to even make a rational statement about it all. They had no idea of this kind of living. They couldn't say anything to their children. There was nothing in the brain of the parents to be able to accommodate these kind of activities. And we see the same thing happening in India now. There's a huge gap in understanding between the parents and their sons and daughters, especially the sons and daughters who go overseas, but not only those who go overseas, those who are growing up in Mumbai, Delhi, Bangalore, even Kolkata is getting a bit like that. So, the parents, they don't understand what you're going through. And it's hard for you to tell them. So, what can you really do? So when you visit home, you touch their feet, you give some money from your earnings, and then come back to Australia, and you have to battle with all these things, which your parents can't understand. Certainly your grandmother, grandfather can't understand. So this is what's happening. This is what I see is happening in India now, this huge gap in understanding between the parents and their sons and daughters. In this way, you're actually quite isolated if you admit that to yourself. You're quite isolated. Who can you turn to for some kind of deep understanding of your situation? You're being cut off from your traditional anchor. Not physically, because you still have your relations with your mother, your father, grandmother, grandfather, but psychologically you're being cut off. And that increases your sense of isolation. So therefore, you have to seek some kind of friends somewhere. So what is the crowd you're going to be a part of? That becomes the important point as you live in the West. What kind of crowd will I be a part of? Because I can't just be completely traditional, like I'm living in some small city in India. No, I'm a world citizen. I have global values. Who can I relate to? Who can I communicate with? And when you don't have anyone who can understand all these things you're going through, your stress increases even more. And because that stress is so great and you feel that you're not understood and you don't feel like there's anyone to whom you can explain yourself, then you figure, I might as well just start drinking, going to clubs. What else is there to do? All the Australians relieve themselves in that way. Let me relieve myself also in that way. And then sometimes it happens. In order to show the Australians that you're genuine, you try to outdo them. I think the last time we had a retreat, one of you was telling me that, I got into the party so much so that even the Australians would tell me, don't drink so much. I got into the ladies so much, even the Australians were telling me, just slow down. I had to show them, I could outdo them. In other words, he got his identity in that way. He felt some security in that way. Although that illusory feeling of security was costing him so much in terms of mental peace, even health. But he had to do something. He had to express himself in some way. So this is what's happening now. And I know that many of you are seriously concerned about this problem. Are you going to just be isolated and overwhelmed by this situation? Or will you be able to find enlivening and enlightening association? An association of persons striving for the highest values, the highest aspirations, the highest goals. This is what we're trying to offer. We're trying to give what Lord Krishna gives. The best lifestyle of balanced material and spiritual needs so that gradually you'll make spiritual progress and be able to understand the material world for what it is, and you'll also understand your spiritual identity and your spiritual needs. That is real progress. Now, let's look at Bhagavad Gita. This is chapter 4. I'll discuss with you from Bhagavad Gita, text 10. Vitaraga bhaya krodha manmaya mam upasrita bhavo jnana tapasa putamad bhavam agata. Bhagavan Sri Krishna is speaking. Being freed from attachment, fear, and anger. Being fully absorbed in me and taking refuge in me. Many, many persons in the past became purified by knowledge of me. and thus they all attained transcendental love for me. Now this is a very interesting verse, because Krishna is outlining the impediments toward living a sane and healthy lifestyle. Those impediments are raga, bhaya, and krodha, attachment, fear, and anger. Now let's try to look into our life and see how much those things are there, attachment, fear, and anger. Let's talk about attachment first of all. Everyone is attached to something. It takes some purification of vision for you to see what you're actually attached to. Why are you working so hard? Why are you studying so hard? What is it that's making you tick? What makes you tick like a clock is attachment. What are those attachments that are pushing you on? It could be attachment to reputation, attachment to appreciation. You want others to appreciate you. You want society to appreciate you. Attachment to status. Status has no value in of itself, except that it brings appreciation and a false sense of honor. When you walk into a room, people buzz it. He's a big achiever. If you're from Mumbai, who knows, soon they may be saying, ooh, he's the big money. and you may overhear that, and you'll feel, yes, yes. These thoughts bounce around in your mind. Big money. Beautiful people. That's where I want to be. Status. Because in this way you feel your life has value. So that's an attachment. There still may be some diminishing attachment that you want to be successful in the eyes of your family. You want them to feel that you're overseas conquering the world. And there's some appreciation you feel for your parents having sacrificed for you, so you want to reciprocate. And then there's attachment to comfort and security. Money will bring me a better life. By my working hard, I'll advance, I'll climb the ladder. There'll be reciprocation in terms of money and security. Of course, what we try to point out here is that that so-called increase in money and security also brings an increase in mental problems, stress, anxiety. Your mental and physical health become destroyed. What to speak of your spiritual health? In any case, we're talking about attachment. Without attachment, you won't do anything. So you have to be very clever to see, what are my attachments? What do I want? No one will work without attachment. No one will study without attachment. There are certain things you are bound to. You're imprisoned by certain desires. Therefore, you labor hard at the university, at the workplace. So in this verse, Krishna is saying, Vitaraga Maya Krodha, being freed from attachment, fear, and anger. We don't realize how much of a burden material attachment is until we become free. While we're suffering under that burden of material attachment, we even feel it to be normal. This is just part of life, to carry a burden. To carry an unnecessary burden is the way you live. I couldn't conceive of another kind of life without this artificial burden. We become so attached to these unnecessary attachments, even though we know that they are a heavy burden. Just struggling under that heavy burden gives us a sense of accomplishment. Just see how I'm struggling. Just see how much stress I'm handling. Just see how much anxiety I'm containing. All this comes about through attachment. What about anger? Now, first we'll go to fear. Vitaraga bhaya krodha. Attachment and then fear. You fear that you're going to lose. You're going to lose your job. I know so many of you, and you're feeling the jitteriness of the IT sector. How long will it be before I'm downsized? Reduced. Mm-hmm. This fear, and I've heard from quite a few of you, that fear can be a very difficult burden to bear because you don't want to be known back home in India that you failed, that you've lost your job. It's hard for people to understand there about it. We sent you to Australia to be CEO in 5 years, and now you tell us you can't send any money back because you've lost your job? How is that possible? You're in Australia. How do you lose your job? Of course, it's quite obvious how you lose your job. Everything's outsourced in. But still, even though that your relatives may read that in the newspaper, they're thinking, they've already boasted, right, to all their friends and neighbors, my son is in Melbourne, attending RMIT, and then, naturally, there'll be a high position after accounting, engineering. So after you've done that, it's very difficult to tell for them to tell the neighbors, yes, to tell the relatives, my son has lost his job. He doesn't know what his next job will be. Maybe it will be in his field of expertise, maybe not. Very difficult to say that. So all this fear plays an enormous role in people's lives. Because of the attachment. You're attached to something and you're afraid I won't get it, or even if I have it, I'm going to lose it. Very devastating for the self to go through this attachment and fear. Will I be able to show myself to be a successful person? And then finally, krodha, anger. This is what will come next. Right now, I know a lot of you are in the attachment and fear stage. But what comes next? The third of the trio is anger. This is what is so much a part of the Western psychology, anger. And it's another reason why everyone takes so much intoxication, to control that anger, to cover it over, to also control the fear, but most importantly, to stop the anger from exploding. Anger comes when your attachments are not fulfilled. You feel that the world owes me something. I did my share. I did everything properly. I studied hard at the university. I tried to satisfy my employer. And then I was just left out in the cold. You become angry. That's the normal cycle of material existence. Attachment, and then fear, and then anger. And in order to keep all that under control, you must take intoxication. So Krishna is saying, being freed from attachment, fear, and anger, being fully absorbed in me and taking refuge in me, many, many persons in the past became purified by knowledge of me, and thus they all attained transcendental love for me. Okay. Krishna is encouraging Arjuna here. Many, many persons, bahavo jnana tapasa, many, many persons have already done this bhakti yoga process. They have succeeded. Similarly, you can also succeed. One great disadvantage of living in the present times is that you feel, well, if Krishna consciousness, if bhakti yoga is so good, why only a few are doing it? That's the nature of the climate today. Everyone is very happy to go crazy, and few are going to take up Krishna consciousness. But that situation can change when those few who take up Krishna consciousness become very spiritually powerful. Then that few can transform the rest of the world. It just takes a few persons who are going to be honest and realize life can't go on in this way. I can't live my life this way. I don't want my children living like this. It just takes a few honest persons, and you can start to influence everyone else. So Krishna is inspiring you in this verse. Many, many persons have already done this. You see, Lord Krishna is seeing the whole span of existence, not only on this planet, but other planets. Not only this time, but previous times, the future. And so Krishna is giving you an accurate statistical statement based on all times and all places. Many, many persons have done this. So if you're going to understand that point, you must broaden your vision and understand that this planet is just one speck of dust in the whole cosmos. If you're going to consider what everyone else is doing, then you have to take into account the whole universe. And the Vedic knowledge tells you that even if you take into account the whole universe, this whole universe is just one mustard seed in a bucket of mustard seeds. There are countless universes. Therefore, when Krishna says, bahavo jnana tapasa, many, many persons have become purified by knowledge of me, purified by austerity. Many, many have already done this. Krishna is taking into account the whole of material existence. In this way, you should feel encouraged. But you have to look to the right persons to take your inspiration from. Otherwise, it looks to you like many, many persons are going the other way. They're going the materialistic way. And look at the result they're getting. We have to decide. What kind of association do I want? Who am I going to associate with? What kind of life do I want for myself and my family? Krishna is inviting you. Come to the highest platform. It is possible. Only that way will you find the satisfaction and peace you're looking for. Being free from attachment, fear, and anger. Being fully absorbed in me and taking refuge in me. That is the whole process of bhakti yoga. How to become absorbed in service to Krishna. How to take shelter of Krishna. Krishna is the supreme consciousness. You are the tiny consciousness. In the Upanishads it is stated, Nityo Nityanam Chaitanas Chaitananam. Out of all the eternal conscious living entities, there is one chief who is maintaining all the others. Both the Supreme and you are conscious. Both the Supreme and you are eternal. But there is one chief conscious and eternal entity amongst all the other eternal conscious entities. The difference between the one And the many is eko bahunam yo vidadati kaman. The one is maintaining everyone else. That supreme consciousness, that supreme personality of Godhead, Bhagavan Sri Krishna, is the focus of a devotee's efforts. If we don't try to please Krishna, then we're going to simply spend all our energies trying to please the temporary world of matter. And this produces all the problems of attachment, fear, and anger. In other words, if we make it our goal to understand Krishna, we can jump over all the problems of the day because we'll become purified. When Krishna says, many persons in the past became purified by knowledge of me, he's talking about his qualities, his activities. By getting knowledge of Krishna, your life becomes transformed. You don't know any other person like that. You don't know any other person for whom, if you get knowledge of that person's activities and qualities, you radically change. You've never met a person like that. That's why Krishna is called Bhagavan, the possessor of all opulence. Sometimes in India, the title Bhagavan is given very cheaply. Someone will call themselves Bhagavan because they can produce a little speck of gold in their hand. But who is Bhagavan who produces the unlimited gold of the universe? That is the real Bhagavan. Bhagavan means the possessor of all opulence. Not just some tiny wealth that comes from some tiny mystical power. So when you hear from Krishna, you are hearing from the source of everything. Especially the source of all opulences. The qualification of Bhagavan Sri Krishna is that he has unlimited opulence. You've never met a person who has unlimited wealth. You've never met a person who has unlimited knowledge. You've never met a person who has unlimited strength or unlimited fame or unlimited beauty. It's amazing. Sometimes persons call themselves Bhagavan in India, and you want to look, well, where is the unlimited beauty? So next time you see someone advertises Bhagavan, you can go up and say, oh, please, show me the unlimited beauty. That is a characteristic of Bhagavan Sri Krishna. Just by trying to understand Krishna, your life will become transformed. By trying to understand Krishna's name, his form, his qualities, his activities, you become purified. And because of that purification, you'll be more easily able to see how to make your way through the dense jungle of today's working world, today's university world. You know it's like a jungle. Survival of the fittest. You've got your machete in your hand, you're chopping your way through the jungle at university, at the workplace, fighting off predators. It's like that. And you get a false sense of pride for surviving in the jungle, although the price that you're paying in terms of mental peace and your own physical health is so high. But you think, I cannot stop living like this. What else is there for me to do? Once again, in Krishna consciousness, in bhakti yoga, we don't say that you stop your work. If you're a family person, you have to maintain your family. But how much does your family need? How much will your family need? has to be a proper balance. The ideal life is one of modest endeavors to maintain the family, while the main priority is spiritual advancement. This is the true art of living in this world. How to save time so that your consciousness will be transformed by knowledge of Krishna. Because Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He has activities. He has qualities. And by hearing about those activities, by hearing about those qualities, your consciousness becomes purified and your dormant attraction for Krishna becomes revived. Now, let's just go over some very interesting points in the purport. Do we need a little air in here? Would that be okay? Let's hear what Srila Prabhupada tells us, amplifying what Krishna is saying. Purport. As described above, it is very difficult for a person who is too materially affected to understand the personal nature of the Supreme Absolute Truth. Generally, people who are attached to the bodily conception of life are so absorbed in materialism that it is almost impossible for them to understand how the Supreme can be a person. Such materialists cannot even imagine that there is a transcendental body which is imperishable, full of knowledge, and eternally blissful. In the materialist concept, the body is perishable, full of ignorance, and completely miserable. Therefore, people in general keep the same bodily idea in mind when they are informed of the personal form of the Lord. This is attachment looked at in a different way. Because of our attachment to material forms, material names, material qualities, we think that that's all there is. As soon as there's quality, form, activity, it must be material. Why do we deduce like that? Why do we reason like that? Because we're attached to the material concept of life. So much so that we consider any time that there is a form, any time there's a body, any time there's a quality or an activity, it must be material. We deduce like this, we reason like this because of attachment to matter. All the forms, all the persons, all the individualities that I've experienced, all the activities, all the qualities are material. Therefore, that's all there is. And then we make the next big mistake. Since any form, any person, any body, any quality, any activity is material, therefore Krishna must be material because he has form, qualities, activities. And then we made the greatest mistake. The whole point of Bhagavad Gita is to get us to see that Krishna's name, form, qualities, and activities have nothing to do with matter. Even when Krishna comes within this material world, he does not lose his 100% pure and spiritual status. Just like the rainbow in the sky seems to rest on the ground. Both ends of the rainbow seem to rest on the ground. But actually, if you try to search out on the ground, where is the rainbow resting? You'll never find it. It only seems to rest on the ground. Similarly, when Krishna comes to this world to speak Bhagavad Gita, it only seems that he's in this world. He's able to appear within this world without taking on the compromises of this world. This is a very important point to understand. And Krishna takes much time to explain it in Bhagavad Gita that even though He comes to this world, he is not a part of this world. By attachment to matter, you falsely conclude that matter is all that there is. And therefore you become averse to hearing about Krishna. Because automatically you assume Krishna is a material person. And then you're not able to benefit from Bhagavad Gita. Let's look at the next thing. Bhaya, fear. This is a different way of considering attachment, fear, and anger. We talked about the first way before, and now we're going to do a different way. We talked about fear previously in terms of fear that your attachments will be jeopardized. A deeper understanding of fear is that you are afraid of having a spiritual identity. Think about that, please. I have an eternal spiritual identity. Why are many people afraid of that? Because they don't know what to do with themselves. And the thought that they're going to be around eternally frightens them. I don't know what to do with myself. I hope that I just end after a life of pleasures, I hope, and not so much pain. I just hope to end. But if you're told that eternally you're going to go on and on, that puts a great responsibility on your shoulders to understand yourself and deal with yourself. Because after all, you're not going anywhere. Just think about it. As soon as you get people to think that they're just temporary, that they're the body, then they lose all respect for themselves. And they just think, my goal in life is to please the body and then I'll just die. But as soon as you are educated spiritually to understand you have an eternal identity, then naturally you start to think, I can't run away from myself. I can't get rid of myself. I might as well learn how to deal with myself as the number one priority in life. So this is a very interesting point that Lord Krishna is making. Fear. Not only do we fear that our attachments will be spoiled, but we also fear having an eternal identity because we don't know what to do with ourselves. You have to think a little deeply to understand this point of fear of your spiritual identity. What will I do if I exist again in the next life and the life after that and life after that? And who's deciding how much I get? I wonder how many of you, when you're walking the streets, when you're back in India and you see some beggar on the street, how many of you think, I could be that in my next life? Did any of you think that? No? Why is it that one person's the beggar and the other person gets to come to Australia, to the heavenly planets, to the lucky country? Why? It's karma. Just like you have a little bit of good karma now, next life could be completely opposite. So what is arranging that one person is high and one person is so low? And what are you doing to make sure that in your next life you won't descend to such a poverty-stricken situation? In other words, if you're going to actually be forward-thinking and responsible, you have to consider the success of your next life, not just the success in this life. But that's frightening to some. Therefore, because they're afraid of having an eternal identity that transcends death. They don't want to think about these things. Just this life is enough. Just let me handle this life. I don't want to think about anything beyond that. There's nothing they taught me at the university to prepare for any next life. And since they didn't teach me it at the university, I don't want to hear. I'm afraid to hear it. I just want to focus right now on my job goals, my career goals. I'll get money, and then I'll focus on making good investments. I'll get a nice house. I'll get a nice car. The wife will also have a car. The children will have cars. And then we'll all have good medical care. And when I die, I'll leave a lot behind for the children, and my life will be successful. But how can your life be successful when you don't know where you're going at death? Maybe some of you here are engaged to be married. Now, suppose your future wife asks you, where will we live after we're married? And you say, don't worry about it. Let just things happen. Will that be a satisfactory answer? Will any lady here be satisfied by such an answer? Your future husband tells you, don't worry about where we'll live. It'll just all work out. Of course not. You'd be very upset, and the girl's father would be on the case of the future husband. What kind of future do you have planned for my daughter? Everything has to be carefully figured out in advance. We will live here. We will do this. We will do that. Why does that kind of forward thinking not apply to death? Let us say you're living in a house and it has no lease, no rental agreement. You can be kicked out at any time. That's known as a very foolish way to live. You don't know when, but any moment you can be put out in the street. No wife will put up with such a situation. None of you men also would put your family in such a situation. But that is the way we handle the death reality. I don't know when it's coming, but let's not think about it. Let's just busy ourselves accumulating security and status. Death can kick you out at any moment, but there's no plan for that. This is known as highly irresponsible living. And this is civilization? You ask the average Australian, what's going to happen to you at death? Don't be negative. I don't have time to think about those things. When death comes, it comes. It sorts itself out. Nature will just do something. We don't know what it is, but maybe there is a next life. People today are willing to consider that there is a next life, but they say, still, don't worry about it. Try not to hurt too many people, and you'll be okay if there is a next life. That's the best they can tell you. No plan, no insurance policy. You have insurance for your car, insurance for your home, no insurance policy for the next life. This is uncivilized living. None of you will accept a rental agreement in which you can be kicked out anymore. Unless you have a backup plan. Okay, because the rent is cheap, we'll live here, even though we have no rental agreement. As soon as we're asked to leave, we'll go stay such and such a place. Mm-hmm. And we'll save so much money meanwhile. You always have a backup plan. But what's the backup plan when death kicks you out? Just a few days ago, in Canada, one wealthy teenage girl, 16 years old, without warning, died because she had a high allergy to nuts. And she was always very careful, of course. She was aware I have a high allergy to nuts. She never ate any nuts. But what happened was her boyfriend kissed her goodnight, and 4 hours later she was dead. And the doctors figured out that the boyfriend, 4 hours before, had eaten some peanuts. And so when he kissed her, just a tiny particles of peanuts were transferred, and it killed her. These things happen. But everyone is feeling, such a thing will never happen to me. But that's not the responsible way to live. You should have some insurance policy in place. You should have some vision of how your life can be progressive. Then you can be said to be responsible for yourself and your family. Otherwise, you just take the unintelligent way of living. Oh, just let whatever happens, happens. We'll be all right. Look at my car. Look at my home. Look at my high-stress job. Look at my children becoming Australian. There has to be something more than this. And this something more is India's greatest contribution to the world. In one of our next sessions, I'll tell you about the happiness problem in the world and how the Indian government was very upset that the United Nations Human Development Task Force ranked India in 128th out of 170 countries in terms of capital development, education, quality of life, and so on. And what they have a minister of human resources in India. And what was his protest? Why do they just look at the material things? They should look at the spiritual contribution. When the pressure comes on that way, then they say, what about the spiritual? Why do they rank us only 128, 12 places ahead of Pakistan? Why don't they look at the spiritual achievement? Why don't they factor that in? Then they protest, right? Otherwise, they won't say anything. But suddenly, all of a sudden, they're bringing up, what about the spiritual achievements, the spiritual intelligence? So, yes, the greatest wealth of India is spiritual knowledge. Unrivaled in the world. And that's what we're developing here. We're tapping into that greatest spiritual wealth of the world. Now, furthermore, in this purport, besides learning that we are afraid of having an eternal spiritual identity, we also find anger. Anger that, oh, there's so many sadhus, so many babas, so many spiritual teachers. Oh, who do you know who to listen to? Just forget them all. Maybe some of you have felt this anger. Anyone? Yes. This is too much, right? Everywhere you go, there's a sadhu, a holy book, this or that, a temple, puja for this, puja for that. This is just easy, just throw it all out, right? And then what? Right, you look at the Australians, they don't have to cope with all that stuff, right? Just in the lucky country, just letting their senses go wild, drinking and, you know, just letting their senses just go crazy, and they never worry about puja, right? They never worry about holy men and sadhus and swamis. Out of anger, you say, wouldn't it be nice just to throw all that stuff out and just have pure industrialism, commercialism? But mixed in a few humanistic values, right? So, this is a very fascinating point. Anger, because you don't know which way to go if you would choose a spiritual solution. And finally, you just forget it all. But it's better to try to educate yourself so you can discriminate what is the highest spiritual knowledge and get that. This kind of education Krishna is seeking to give you in Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita means you are getting the topmost education because you're hearing from the topmost person, Bhagavan Sri Krishna, the possessor of unlimited opulence. Therefore, there's no need to be angry if you're getting the best. It's like our Nityananda Priya was telling how in my earlier in life, I went to what is known as the best undergraduate university in USA, where most of the presidents come from. In the past, in the recent presidential election, both presidents, both candidates, Bush and the other one, they're from Yale. So, when students go to such an institution, Yale, Harvard, they feel they're on top of the world. I know. I remember how it felt. You have attained the top of Mount Everest. Your success is guaranteed. When you graduate, you don't look for a job. The jobs come looking for you. You just sit back and employers contact you. Oh, please work for our company. Please work for our corporation. Even before you graduate, they're recruiting. So you feel like, I have attained the highest level. Ah, my future will be glorious. Of course, what is the real glory of such a future? Money and influence. But that won't make you happy. That won't make you peaceful. But still you feel that way. I have attained. I have achieved. In Japan, their top institution is the Todai in Tokyo. Tokyo University, Todai. And to get into the Todai, you have to start studying in cram schools when you are 4 years old. And every day after school, you go to an evening school for several hours. You have to start that at the age of four so that you're able to memorize all the knowledge you need to get the highest marks in the test to go to the Todai. And so you do that for 13 or 14 years. From the time you're 4 to the time you're 17 or 18. You go to regular school during the day and then cram school at night. And then the fortunate few are accepted to Tokyo University, the Todai. And then they don't study anymore. Don't ask them to study anymore. They've already achieved the highest planet. So, it's nice to achieve. There's no doubt. To achieve something, to achieve a status gives you a certain feeling. But we have to understand what is the real status we want. So that we can actually, intelligently, feel that I've accomplished something worthwhile. The whole point of Bhagavad Gita is to get you to understand there's nothing more worthwhile than getting knowledge of Krishna. Knowledge of Krishna is not theoretical. It transforms. It elevates. It purifies. It connects you to the eternal source of all pleasure. To understand this point is the greatest education, the greatest attainment. So, Nityananda Priya was explaining how Yale University costs $25,000 a year. Now, after 4 years there, when I graduated, a month after I graduated, I spent $3 to get a Bhagavad Gita as it is. And as I read Bhagavad Gita as it is, the first thing I said was, now I finally am getting a real education. This acquisition of a genuine Bhagavad Gita by a genuine devotee of Krishna, with no speculation, no false interpretation, but straight Bhagavad Gita as is, I said, this is the greatest education I've been looking for. Once I finished Bhagavad Gita, then I was yearning for the graduate study to Bhagavad Gita, the PhD program, Srimad Bhagavatam. And then when I started reading that, I said, I've never seen such a wealth of knowledge. I have never seen an author who knows so much. And I had studied everything at the university. I didn't take any math or science, but I took the history of science, history of technology, history of this, history of that, political history, economic history. In fact, at Yale, most of the professors who write textbooks for other universities around the world, they are teaching at Yale. So I had classes with them. So I had seen the best minds. I had seen the future political leaders of the country. My persons right in the same dormitory as me, later they would become mayors of big cities in America, big corporate heads. One, I found out later, became a devotee of Krishna. Later we met in Krishna consciousness. But most went to the top positions in the USA. I saw their lives, how dissatisfied they were, how they had no peace, how they couldn't wait for the weekend to come so they could drink. I saw the girls throwing themselves away for these men. Just canvassing them, come to my room, come to my room. Because the girls are taught that that's liberated behavior. Why should you be a traditional lady and wait for a man to call you? Go out and get one. They're pushed in that way. You're just as good as a man. Why should you wait for a man to pick you? You go pick a man. Why waste your time? Get into it. Just don't sit by the phone waiting for it to ring, for some man to call you to take you to the movies. You go out and get one. This way you're equal. I saw this happening. And I saw the results, the psychological results, how the students were suffering so much. But they couldn't admit it because the success was there. We are at Yale. And when we finish Yale, we're going to get the highest posts. They were blinded by that, and they couldn't even see their own suffering and their own misery, although it was so intense. So I'm praying that this won't happen to you, that you'll become blinded by all the false success and achievement. You'll be so blind you won't see your own suffering. You won't see your own insecurity, lack of peace, dissatisfaction. And then you'll push the same thing on your children. So I'm appealing to you all to go a different route. And those of you who have already started on the Krishna conscious path, to increase your dedication to following Krishna's instructions so that we can show a different way of living. So we can demonstrate the greatest lifestyle knowledge, the greatest wealth in how to live by putting into practice Krishna's instructions. right before I graduated, I went to my dean of studies, and I told him, you know, I don't see any future for myself in materialistic society as it is. He didn't take me seriously. He just looked me in the eye and said, you are a Yale man. You will influence the world. So, maybe he was right in a way that he didn't expect. So similarly, we want that you all influence the world. Your families, your children, as well as your associates, let them see the value of Krishna's instructions in action. Otherwise, they'll think it's just Hindu mythology, it's just some religious beliefs. But when they see you and your behavior and your level of consciousness, that's what will make them think. This is what has happened to you. I know none of you came to Australia expecting to embark upon the path of bhakti. How many of you planned to do that when you came to Australia? Raise your hand. I'm going to go to Australia and there I'll find Krishna. I'm going to go to Australia and there I'll begin to study Bhagavad Gita. Did you think like that is another thing? What did you think? I'll go to Australia and find what? Job. What else? Come on. Huh? Success. What does that mean? Let's get more specific. Huh? What?
Money.
And then with the money, what do you get?
Pleasure.
What kind of pleasure? Such as? Car, house, what else? Women, yeah. TV, yes. What else? That's about all there is to materialistic life. Also, meat eating. Yes. Maybe some of you, your families in India were vegetarian, but when you came to Australia, you started to eat meat because of that. So easy, go to McDonald's, KFC, fast food. Intoxication is normal here, drinking. I know quite a few of you started doing these things here. And in your heart you know, this is not very good. It's actually not very pleasurable, but you don't know anything else to do. And you think this is part of being successful. None of you thought, I'm going to go to Australia and become Krishna conscious. Now what happened? Somehow, because of your good fortune, buried deep inside you, you are looking for something higher. Yes, you'll go on working, you'll have families, but you're looking for a higher level of living. That is your good fortune. You're not able, even if you tried, you're not able to live the normal low life. So you might as well just accept that. It didn't work. You might have wanted to. When I go to Australia, I'm forgetting all this traditional stuff. I'm going to get into it. I'm a good guy. Right? It didn't work for you. It wasn't able to happen. That's your good fortune. You have something else going for you. And that something else going for you is meant to impress the whole world, to influence the whole world. That something else you have going for you is attachment to spiritual values, spiritual culture, attachment to Krishna, and a desire for your spiritual identity. Not a fear of your spiritual identity, but a desire for your spiritual identity. These are your assets. So while pushing ahead with your career, because most of you are going to be family persons if you're not already, okay, you have to work, but it's not the main goal in life. work to support a spiritual lifestyle, then the work has meaning. We'll be talking more about that in the coming sessions, how to work so that it's meaningful and productive. All right, any questions? Usually the first session, everyone's shy about questions. And then tomorrow, and the flood comes. The floodgates open tomorrow. Yes.
I have a question.
Okay.
We spoke about our culture. We spoke about losing our cultural values, etc. What do you think that we should collectively be doing as a set of people to at least influence ourselves as well as others to kind of hold on to the to our culture without really being passionate, etc.
You see, because you're educated, and actually you're not all traditional. And even if you were traditional, it wouldn't be possible to hold on to your traditional lifestyle overseas. So, the only way that you can progress is to actually understand something that is lost in India now. What is the point of all the traditions? What's the point of all the culture? You are not going to be able to just act in certain traditional cultural ways just for the sake of doing that. But when you study Krishna's teachings in Bhagavad Gita, you finally understand what the purpose of all that tradition and culture is. That's the superior position. Otherwise, simply to mechanically do all the externals, the wrapping, without knowing what's inside, it's not going to appeal to you. You'll reject it. You already have rejected it, really. You can't live as your grandparents have lived, and only to some degree can you live like your parents have lived. You've been trained with an academic mind, so you want to understand why. Why do we do these things? Not just simply, we don't behave in this way because grandmother did not behave in this way. That's not going to be enough for you. So, when you study Krishna's teachings in Bhagavad Gita, you see why there is a culture of sense control, a culture of restraint. What's the purpose of it? The purpose is not simply just to restrain yourself. The purpose is to attain Krishna. So once you understand, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Vedaischa sarvai ahameva veja. By all the Vedas I am to be known, Krishna says. That means when you say Vedic culture, you're saying Krishna culture, because Krishna is the conclusion of the Vedas. All the purpose of all those cultural mannerisms is to bring you to Krishna. But if you take Krishna out of the picture, you're just left with this huge system of dealings and behavior, and it seems a big burden after a while. And so now many of you are questioning, what's the point of all this huge burden of ways you're supposed to behave and etiquette and dealings? And wouldn't it be better just to, maybe not completely, but to some degree, be like the Australians, just chuck it all out the window and just be a good mate? It seems so easy, doesn't it? I'm sure you watch them and you think, well, I don't know if I could be as wild as them, but there seems to be some advantage in being so carefree and open. Right? Don't you think that? Yes. Yeah. Look at the girls. They just let everything be exposed. They don't worry what their mother thinks, what their father thinks. Yeah, mother and father don't even live together. But they don't have any hang-ups like we do. We have so many inhibitions.
when we go to the movies. Oh, what we see on the movie screen. Like, this is, why can't we be like that? Passion. Not even passionate romance, but just passion without romance.
So you get this kind of guilt complex that, why are we following still these traditions? And then you think, I know, if you just start drinking, then you can just easily lose all your inhibitions. Yes? Especially the main day. Many of you have tried that. Just take a few drinks, and all memories of what grandmother taught you are gone. Now, also, the Indian girls are getting into that. Because there's so much pressure. They want to be like the girls in the movies. Because that's what the men want. And that's how to have fun. But we can't be like that. We've been told since childhood that you should not be accessible. Oh, if I take a few drinks, then I'll be able to loosen up and I'll be more able to have fun. And this is what's going on. And now what do you see more and more is happening? When the students are coming overseas to Australia, boyfriend and girlfriend are starting to live together, right? Right? Something unheard of even 10 years ago. Now it's quite common. And even the parents, if they find out, they may be supporting. Well, it's the way they do things in the West, and as long as they're studying and completing their degree. That is the main thing. It's probably true. They shouldn't marry now because it would interfere with their studies. Let them just live together. And then when they finish school, they'll marry. And we'll have a big wedding. So all this is going on. So, if you don't understand the point of the traditions, no intelligent person today, young person like you, will follow them. It's just a burden. But if you understand the goal of all the culture, then it's easy to follow what is beneficial. It's not a burden. It's actually a liberating feature of your life. That's why in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about the regulative principles of freedom. These principles that Krishna is teaching in the Gita give you real freedom. But by pursuing the demands of your senses, you become a slave of your senses. You become miserable. So we need an association of persons who we can experience these truths with. And then they become real for us. I know many of you are afraid of just having religious beliefs, going backwards into time. What Krishna is teaching in Bhagavad Gita is perceived by the senses. You'll see the difference. And many of you who are chanting Hare Krishna, practicing bhakti yoga, you have seen the difference. And that is what makes the day a perceivable difference. You can actually taste the spiritual reality. That is the goal of all the culture. Anything else?
Hare Krishna, Guruji. You talked about having a suitable balance in day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
Could you quote me a typical scenario wherein you have the right ingredients for spiritual as well as materialistic?
Very good question. Well, we have examples in this audience. We have very dedicated spiritual practitioners, spiritual adepts, and they are working, they have their IT jobs, they have wife, they have child, but they understand what is the purpose of their working, or what is the purpose of their studying? It's to have a peaceful lifestyle for supporting their spiritual practices. It's all about priorities. When you have your priorities properly in place, then you can proceed ahead in life properly. They are not seeking their satisfaction for material achievement. They use material achievement how to have a more peaceful lifestyle. And if the material achievement threatens their inner peace and spiritual progress, they don't chase after that material achievement. That's where the balance comes in. You can only make the balance when you know where is your satisfaction coming from. When you know that your satisfaction is not coming from material achievement, automatically you'll balance your life so that you can have time and energy for the real fulfillment. So we have examples here. Krishna conscious persons, they have gone to university, they have graduated, they have families, they are getting families, they're working, but there's something else going on in their life. So you get to know them and you'll see the balance in action. Yeah, last night, I had an interesting experience. Part of my balance for my occupation, which is constant traveling, is I have to exercise. If you're flying around the world twice a year, you don't exercise, your health will be destroyed. So I exercise. Often I go swimming, especially as soon as I get off of a long intercontinental flight. The best thing is to go swimming, and that way you quickly get over the jet lag. So in order to be ready for today, I had to exercise last night. I can't say, oh, I'm not the body, I'm the spirit soul, I don't need to exercise. It doesn't work like that. That's the balance. The body is a machine I have to keep in proper shape, especially for me to serve you properly. I have to. If I just come here and start falling asleep while I'm talking, oh, excuse me, I just got off the plane from Mumbai. Hey, you know, we came all the way out here for the weekend, and the speaker cannot prepare himself properly when he's using this. But, so, I have to do my part. So I went to the St. Kilda saltwater baths where I go for swimming, because salt water is better than swimming just in chlorine water. And so, and then, when I got into the water, there was one of you there. He was swimming too. He was surprised. Swamiji Maharaj, oh, I'm so surprised to see you here. I said, well, I could say the same thing. I'm surprised to see you here. I said, you have a body, you're trying to take care of it. I have a body, I'm trying to take care of it. What is the mystery? My body is used in Krishna's service. I have to take care of it. It's Krishna's property. Actually, this person, he said he wasn't able to come today because of work circumstances, but he's coming tomorrow. So, we all have various things we have to do in order to live, but those things aren't the most important. I'm not going to tell you swimming is the most important thing in my life. No. It's a supportive thing. Similarly, work and studies can't be the most important thing in your life. That doesn't mean you don't do them well. It's just because something is not the most important thing doesn't mean you shouldn't do it well. You understand? When I swim, I swim well. Why? Because I had a private tutor to teach me how to swim properly, the proper technique, everything. In that way, it's more beneficial for the body. So I had a private tutor for 10 sessions some years ago in New Zealand, and the tutor taught me the proper technique for swimming, how to put less stress on the muscles, how to breathe, alternate breathing on one side and the other, rhythm with your breathing. It's very good for your health. So I try to swim well. It doesn't mean I think swimming is the ultimate goal of my life. It's like if you ask me about flying, I can tell you all about airlines, which are the best, which are the worst, so on and so forth. I can tell you about airlines in India, airlines in Asia, USA. I can tell you the seat pitch. Seat pitch means the distance between the back of this seat and the back of the seat in front of you. In case you've flown a lot, you may notice some airlines very little seating space, others have more. I can tell you the numbers. Thai Airlines, 34 inches. Singapore Airlines, 32 inches. Qantas, 31 inches. Air New Zealand, 34 inches. I can tell you all. Because when you fly, you have to be concerned with how much leg room there is, otherwise you'll get to your destination after a 12-hour flight. Your body will be totally cramped. So you have to know all these things. So that's part of the balance. It's not the most important thing, though. So similarly, so many of you are studying, so many of you are working. That's all right. But don't make it the most important thing in your life. Do it well, but don't sacrifice your spiritual achievement. So we have examples of how to do that here. And as you get to know the seasoned practitioners of Krishna consciousness more, you'll be able to learn from their lifestyle. Some of them have wife, some child still. They're going on. It's not an impediment, it's not a barrier. I'm a specialist. That's why I'm dressed this way. There has to be a specialist in every field. But most are not specialists. They're general practitioners. So you can do that. Yes, what do you think? Yeah.
It's all about well-being, isn't it? For the mind as well as the soul.
Exactly. Total well-being for the body, for the mind, and for the soul. So I'm a specialist. I'm like a research professor. Well, not everyone's going to be a research professor. But that doesn't mean you can't become educated just because your goal is not to be a research professor. So there's room in Krishna consciousness for all types of lifestyles. Krishna is always the center. Krishna is always the goal. You're going to have children? Have spiritual children. You're going to have a wife? Have a spiritual wife. Have a spiritual family. That would be the best thing you can do for yourself and for the world. What's our schedule?
We'll be serving for some.
Okay. So we'll be discussing more this evening as well as tomorrow. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.